Thank you, Vikun. So Susan and I have the somewhat uncomfortable task of talking about a lot of subjects, some of which we know quite well, but also some of which with the real experts that are sitting here in the audience, people who we invited this week to come and be part of the biological contingent this week telling you about mitochondria and chloroplasts. So I'd like to encourage Kathy and Carol and Bill to please jump in and prevent us from embarrassing ourselves, because there's definitely a risk of that. But we've tried to think about what some of the most important points of to tell you, assuming you have very little background in what mitochondria and chloroplasts are, because we've all been working in the field and we think they're fascinating, and hopefully we'll convince you that there are a bunch of really rich questions that are open for investigation and could use the approaches of physics, hopefully. So first I'm going to, so this is just an outline for my portion of the talk. I'm going to talk about the very basics of what mitochondria and chloroplasts look like in the cell, why they're there, what functions they're performing. The amazing, remarkable thing about these organelles is that it's very clear that they are the result of very long time ago in evolution, one bacterial cell being engulfed by what was probably a eukaryotic cell that already had a nucleus. And we can read the evidence of that to support that theory is both in at the DNA sequence level, because these organelles in fact retain their own genomes, but also a lot of the evidence is cell biological in nature. And so this is actually when Susan and I started talking with Casey about this week a number of months ago, we felt like this is one of the best examples in biology of evolution and cell biology really making sense together, because you wouldn't have had these organelles without evolutionary processes. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the genomes of these organelles, because this has been the basis for understanding what we know about their evolution. And we also, we've posted a couple things on the evolution of these genomes on the wiki, I guess. So those are there for you to peruse as well. And I'll talk briefly about protein targeting and import, and then Susan has a talk with many more beautiful pictures than I have about the sort of the cell biology and the organization physically of these organelles within the cells. So these pictures, so we have a mitochondrion and a chloroplast on the left, and mitochondrion on the left, chloroplast on the right. Chloroplast is colored green because they often are. That's the reason when you look at a plant why it's green, although it turns out that you can have versions of chloroplasts that have different, some other pigments in them as well, and different algae, red algae have somewhat different pigments than green algae. I'll start with some of the similarities between these two organelles. They both have an outer membrane and an inner membrane, and so outer membrane, inner membrane. What I added to this figure, this is out of a textbook, but they somehow left out the part that both of these organelles have their own genomes that are independent of the nuclear genome of the organism. And then there are complex folded membrane structures in mitochondria called cristae, and Susan's going to talk a lot more about the formation of these membrane folds. I think it's a fascinating area for study, how you get self-assembly into these structures, and they are very important for function. And then in chloroplasts, you have stacks of membranes. So the stroma is the counterpart to the matrix, and then you have these stacks of thylakoid membranes that are organized into so-called grana. And so again, there's this interesting organization within. It's not just a bag of proteins and DNA. There's strong organization and membrane organization that's really neat to think about.
Hey,
yes?
Sorry. How big is the genome?
I will get to that later, but it's actually quite variable. So if you look across evolution, you can find examples that are probably the ancestral state, closer to an ancestral state where there are a lot of genes and it's approaching the size of a bacterial genome, but typically a lot of genes have been lost, and in some cases to the extreme. So I have more pictures of that later, but the genomes are far reduced, and these organelles are not capable of surviving on their own. They require input from the host in order to grow and to replicate. replicate. So at the most basic level, mitochondria are burning sugar to make ATP. That's a vast oversimplification. And chloroplasts are assimilating carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to make sugar. And then your idea of the interaction of life, because this releases CO2, and plants with chloroplasts can use the CO2 to make oxygen, and so we all get along very well. But there are also other important functions that happen and are localized to these organelles. And I apologize, Kathy, because this is a mitochondrially biased view. I was sitting there yesterday trying to come up with more things that perhaps you can add to the chloroplast. But mitochondria store calcium ions, and actually their essential function there are some organisms like yeast where, in fact, you don't need to burn oxygen at all. You can get by perfectly well just fermenting sugar, and that makes ethanol, which is great, and you don't even need to do respiration. Yet, the yeast that can dispense with oxidation still have to manufacture iron sulfur compounds in their mitochondria. So it's an important site biologically of manufacture. For organisms like us, we also can use mitochondria to produce heat, and then the mitochondria are important in apoptosis or cell death. So what have I missed here, Kathy?
Chloroplasts are actually plastids. There are a whole bunch of different plastid types in plants. Chloroplasts are the photosynthetic organelles, and they're green. But various types of plastids that synthesize lots of starch, amyloplasts, amino acids, particularly aromatic amino acids, membrane lipids and oils. So our vegetable oils are mostly synthesized in plastids. Carotenoids, orange and yellow pigments. So there are a lot of different kinds of secondary metabolites that are produced.
And so often a lot of what we want from plants is actually being manufactured in chloroplasts.
Yes. A lot of agriculturally important compounds.
Bill.
I've been puzzling for a while as I think about mitochondria, about whether or not some of the metabolic intermediates that they generate in the process of oxidative phosphorylation, if those are important outside of the mitochondria. And I haven't found the answers that are just right in my face anywhere. Maybe you know the answer.
I think that there's, the idea of like superoxide being a mitogen to cells, I think that there's definite potential for release of compounds from oxidation that are signaling, but I haven't found. One of the things is visualizing this stuff is hard, I don't always believe these molecular probes things that say that they're supposed to visualize redox.
I just remember all those diagrams from 1972 when I was in college. So the arrows going from one product to the next, and loops and networks of arrows, and all those things must do something other than what the arrows say.
Yeah.
I don't
know.
But you're thinking more from the perspective of what the mitochondria is giving to the rest of the cell versus trying to keep in the mitochondria, like free radicals that are produced?
So in the chloroplasts, they make lipids, they make starches, they make a lot of things. Do some of the carbon compounds generated in mitochondria as it breaks things down, do those go out and do things? Do they help build amino acids? Do they help make strange lipids?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Definitely do.
That's what I was trying to pick up.
Biosynthetic pathways, a lot of them run through the mito. A lot of the breakdown pathways run through the mito, too, and that's just two examples.
And so, but always it's presented to me as I'm reading reviews and things, the mitochondria, they do ATP, they store calcium, and they regulate cell death.
Nobody's interested in amino acid breakdown and synthesis. I mean, I am, but, I'm weird.
I am too.
There's actually two examples that I I'm sort of getting involved with that have to do with actually progesterone synthesis that actually also has to occur in the placenta in the mitochondria because they acquire cholesterol function and they acquire cholesterol in the mitochondria for that to occur. And actually there may be an association between remodeling mitochondrial inner structure and allowing this behavior. But then, of course, clearly, you know, it gets exported and used in the entire organism. Like,
wow.
So there's all sorts of nice examples of that slowly coming out that are not just in the US.
Well, like aconitase, I mean, it needs iron sulfur cluster. They're made in the mito. They have to come out and work in cytoplasmic aconitase. So.
Have you heard of this weird phenomenon in the posterior of the Drosophila oocyte, where the mitochondria gather, and then they evert their ribosomes, and those ribosomes, bacterial ribosomes, are in the cytoplasm of the eukaryote, and they have important functions. And when you stop that process, the embryo dies.
I have not read this.
So I don't remember who did it, but I can go look for that.
Okay,
it's very cool.
Can you elaborate on this calcium storage function? Because this is not something that I had in mind.
So calcium is an important signaling molecule in the cell, and they both mitochondria and ER, and it's becoming clear now that there are interconnections and communication between mitochondria and ER. And they have the calcium ion concentration in the cytoplasm is quite low, and whereas in the mitochondria the stores are high. And I don't know, I mean, Bill, from your work, you can. I don't know if you guys have thought much about the role of this in neurons and so forth.
The role of calcium?
Yeah.
No, not the role of calcium, the role of mitochondria in calcium storage versus
ER. So one of the ideas is that in the ER, depending on what the ER needs calcium wise and what the cell needs calcium wise, that you can transfer that to the mitochondria because the ER and mitochondria have lots of tight junctions and vice versa. And the mitochondria and the ER also get distributed in the cell differently. So depending on where you need to get high levels of calcium to really rapid signaling to, that the mitochondria functions as a sort of, you know, another structure in the cell that can then, you know.
I mean, I don't know what bacteria do with calcium. I assume they keep calcium quite low as well and sequester it. I don't know. That's a great question.
Very little. The answer is that they do things with calcium, and that's about the extent of. I mean, it's certainly important for membrane structure in bacteria. And some hints that there are localized.
So are there specific pumps that are expressed on mitochondria?
Yes, yeah. There are specific pumps and voltage regulation and so forth. And I don't know the specific genes involved in that.
Is Andre here yet, by chance? I guess we have someone here this week who actually is studying a lot of the pumps.
The electrophysiology of it, yeah.
You could tell me a lot about that.
So, I believe the question about the apoptosis that saw that. Of course, thinking of apoptosis as something that evolved in conjunction with multicellularity.
Mm-hmm.
So, can one see anything in comparing mitochondria in single cell eukaryotes versus multicellular?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I'm skeptical of the yeast apoptosis work and whether yeast obviously die, but you'll find that there's a whole field of yeast apoptosis and yeast are single cell, and it's not clear to me that apoptosis is the same thing. And and clearly yeast don't regulate, they haven't evolved to regulate apoptosis in quite the same way. In multicellular organisms, you have BCL proteins that are at the mitochondrial membrane and are directly regulating mitochondrial integrity and thus apoptosis, which has got added on in multicellularity, although I'm not quite sure where the BCLs come in.
Well, one of the things that sort of that ties in the mitos that are in uni versus multicellular organisms is, you know, you have fusion and fission machinery, which I'll show a little bit later, and, you know, one of the things that has to happen in apoptosis is that you have to release this protein cytochrome C, and when you do that by fragmenting the mitos and messing with their PSPA and releasing this, And the regulation of the proteins that actually divide up the mitochondria is very different in, for example, yeast versus mammalian cells. And partly that's because the same fission proteins that are very similar in behavior have completely different regulation. So if you think about it evolutionarily, I think you could slowly build on, now the fission proteins not only, do the division, but they also bring, the backs, the proteins that are required for signaling of apoptosis to the mitochondria. And so you get this feedback that can slowly sort of build. And that's not actually pleasant in yeast. So even though yeast apoptosis is really cool for yeast folks to think, oh, yes, we also have a pathway to study, that regulation is very different at that level. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yes, they're specific.
Just because the mechanism of cell death is different doesn't mean that it's when you have units, you have prokaryotes which have programmed cell death. This is not driven by oxidation and these sorts of things. So you do, this might just be one accidental mechanism by which it was achieved. It's clear that programmed cell death is useful even for free living organisms.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I put this slide in to sort of provide a taste of some of the problems that are presented by once you evolved having an organelle and the reality that most of the proteins that actually end up in the organelle are encoded in the nucleus. So there's a problem of selecting which proteins should go to the organelle and getting them there properly. And then the organelle needs to replicate its own genome and divide appropriately to maintain the amount maintain the amount you need, but probably too much of any given organelle is also bad. So there has to be some regulation of the host, and the organelle needs to be under control. And then the organelle is encoding its own genes, and so typically many of the complexes of respiration and of photosynthesis have components that are organelle encoded that are proteins that get assembled with nuclear encoded proteins, and so that needs to be coordinated. And actually, Carol will probably tell you some beautiful examples of that sort of coordination. And then the organelles themselves have to, their localization within the cell is regulated and complex. And Susan will tell you a lot more about this. This is just a picture of a yeast cell, which is where most of the work that I'll talk about that I've done is. So this is a phase contrast image, and so I have a yeast cell that's growing by budding, which is the way yeast normally grow, and so it's growing off this small daughter cell. And then the mitochondria here are labeled with a GFP marker, and so you can see that they're distributed throughout the cell. There's all sorts of interesting loops and structures, and once again, Susan can tell you a lot about that. And then the mitochondria are beginning to localize into the daughter cell, and in yeast, that's a regulated process, and it's becoming very clear that if you also look at multicellular organisms, it's very important that whether it's mitochondria or chloroplast, that you get the right amount of well-functioning organelle to pass on to the next generation.
So one question that we discussed a bit last week, not sure we came to a good resolution, is so I guess we learned that the number of mitochondria can be in the thousands, and so the question arises, how does the cell know to make the right number of mitochondria in each cell cycle?
I wanted to just get a little number of mitochondria really quickly. How do you count an entity that can be in any state of fusion and fission?
Number of genomes. Yeah. I wasn't thinking that, but that's a very good way. Yeah. I think to at least have a number to count by. But if it's important to get the right partitioning, is it also important, or how does the cell regulate that production of mitochondrial DNA as well?
This is a problem that I've been interested in, and I've done some screens, So a couple of basic things, it's regulated by cell size. So as cells grow, typically the mitochondria grow, and it's not linked, at least in yeast, it's pretty clear that it doesn't matter if you're doing DNA replication or not. If cells get bigger, typically you get mitochondria roughly in proportion to cell size. Now, in fact, in plants, there's been a lot more, I would say, beautiful sort of biophysics level type work done in terms of the homeostasis between plant cell size and chloroplast. So it would seem that both both in mitochondria and in chloroplast, there is a there's some homeostatic mechanism. But now if I go and I give you a bunch of different mammalian cells, there are a ton more mitochondria in something like muscle tissue where you have energy requirements, as opposed to an adipocyte, which is storing fat and actually does some very interesting and weird things with its mitochondria, or as opposed to a fibroblast, which is growing much less actively than something like a muscle cell that has a lot of turnover of energy. So there, during development, there's a process that says we need more mitochondria. There's a couple transcription factors in mammals that seem to be important, but it's a lot to coordinate, and we don't fully understand it. Yeah.
So I wonder, is it more accurate to say, so we're talking about number of mitochondria, but maybe is it really what you're talking about is mitochondrial compartment volume?
Yes. In my talk, actually, I measure that around these cells, and we'll talk into
that. Okay. And actually, in the case of mitochondria, it's pretty clear that there is a sensor of sort of oxidative capacity. So there are certain diseases that are called ragged red muscle fiber diseases, where if you come into the doctor and you have this muscle weakness and they give you a biopsy and they look under the scope and they see these muscle fibers that are just packed with mitochondria, and they're bright red due to the stain that they use, completely packed. But those are actually the muscle fibers that are basically deficient in phosphorylation. So it's as if there's a signal that we don't have enough oxidative phosphorylation, let's make some more mitochondria, but it's futile because you make more, but because of the genetic deficiency, they're not going to work. And so that's a piece of evidence that argues that there's a signal, but nobody has successfully figured out the nature of that signal and how sort of oxidative status is being sensed.
Are you going to explain the point four?
I'm leaving point four for Susan. So, yes. In this portion of the talk, I'm going to convince you that the mitochondria and chloroplasts really are the result of an endosymbiotic event. And so this, it sounds very interesting, the talk that was given last week on evolution, and I would probably benefit from listening to that, because the construction of trees like this is not entirely straightforward or simple. But one of the elements that's in common in the genome of mitochondria, as well as any other free living organism you look at, is the small subunit ribosomal RNA. And so this is a tree that was constructed on the basis of changes during evolutionary time to the DNA sequence of this small subunit ribosomal RNA. And it turns out that the genomes of plant mitochondria and plant chloroplasts end up squarely, so that this gene in the genome is far more related to that of eubacteria than it is to eukaryotes, and then archaebacteria are their own deal entirely. So by sequence analysis, if you look at the ribosomes that are encoded in the genomes of mitochondria and chloroplasts, they actually look like those of bacteria and not like those of eukaryotes. And so this was, and actually people knew this because you can look sort of biochemically at ribosome structure, and people knew this almost before DNA sequencing was an option. Yeah.
So if you draw the same mitochondrial DNA proteins, do you get the same?
You get some differences, and so there start to be examples of horizontal transfer if you look at one protein versus another. Many of the proteins do look very bacterial, and even today, some of the structural proteins that determine the shape of mitochondria are directly derived from bacterial sequences and are not eukaryotic in nature at all. But I'll show you a chart later on about how, since a lot of genes are lost in these genomes, one of the few things that's in common are these ribosomal subunits, and so they're probably maybe the best thing to look at when you're drawing this sort of tree. And so my argument that mitochondria and chloroplasts are bacterial origin, and as Kathy said, I should be saying plastids, their size is consistent with the prokaryote. They look, they actually look about that size. These organelles are surrounded by two membranes, and the hypothesis is that the outer one came from the host who engulfed the bacterium, and then the inner one was the bacteriums. These organelles have their own genome, and that genome looks like that, those of bacteria rather than those of eukaryotes. And so those are, I would say, the main arguments of this evolutionary hypothesis.
So this
yes.
membrane argument is
yes.
meaning that there were two engulfing
So that there was one, so you had a bacterium and a eukaryotic cell that ate the bacterium, and
that would be one membrane.
So, actually, I have a great picture. Let me go to. So, in fact, chloroplasts are even more interesting. So we have plastids that are. So we'll talk here. I will posit that I have a cell with a mitochondrion because in the case of plants, it looks like plastids came after. And so when you have now we have a cyanobacterium, which is a photosynthetic bacterium being engulfed by this eukaryotic cell. And so the result is you have the membrane of the cyanobacterium and then the membrane of the host. And so that, so you end up with two, yeah.
Actually, well, yeah. I've asked people who actually work on chloroplast evolution, which I don't, where the outer envelope membrane came from chloroplast membrane, and they say it's mostly bacteria.
Okay.
Sorry, so cyanobacteria have
two membranes, right?
But there are certainly things from the host, and so it's a sort of hybrid membrane.
Yeah, and in the case of mitochondria, they were alpha proteobacteria, or they're most similar, which are a single membrane organism. Although there are certainly many bacterial aspects of the outer membrane of mitochondria as well. I mean, they have outer membrane proteins that are effectively bacterial. That are
But are they pointed the right way? They're exposed to the cytoplasmic aluminal surface with the correct topology.
That is. I wouldn't know how far back to go to decide what topology was. In terms of these proteins, in which they're pointed in the way that makes sense for things to go into the bacterium or to be exported, but some of these things got co-opted also.
I wonder if that's an easy thing to change because it's just a matter of the transfer sequences, and their order.
What about lipid composition or synchrony on those membranes?
I don't know. And in the case of plastids, there are examples where you have a secondary engulfment of a. So you have this. Now it's an. We'll say it's like an algae, and you've got a primary chloroplast with two membranes, and you're right, maybe mostly of bacterial origin. And then this gets engulfed by a second eukaryote, and so now you have a. So now you end up with something with at least three membranes. So you end up with four membranes. So you have the engulfed membrane of the. So the host has this membrane that it used to engulf it. Then you have what you engulf, its membrane, and so you end up with four membranes in between. But then there's cases where there's three membrane plastids. So something got lost at some point or whether it happened at the engulfment or not, if the mechanism of engulfment. So there are sort of Russian nesting dolls of plastids that you can find out in the environment. And looking at the cell biology of this, knowing how many membranes is at least suggestive of what the history might have been. And you also, and in this case, you end up with the interesting problem of if you have a gene encoded by this nucleus, what has to happen targeting-wise if you need to get a protein all the way into this chloroplast genome?
I have one more weird question. And there's this assumption that I've always had that you can only get a membrane from a pre-existing membrane.
I would tend to have that assumption too, but...
Any evidence that you might be able to...
The vacuoles can be...
...a new membrane?
Vacuoles can be assembled with no previous vacuole in yeast with absolutely no contribution, so I guess...
But they come from the other membrane compartments.
But they do come from the other, yeah. But they come from the other membrane compartments, but... But at least you're assembling a separate compartment that's...
What would you, I mean, what would be the scenario in which you could imagine having, like some...
You'd have to use some template to shield the hydrophobicity and build a two-layer membrane, like a protein template or something like that. Or, you know, I don't know what kind of molecule, but some kind of molecule that could build it one layer at a time.
In this case of the second, in the case of mitochondria, there's cases of apposition to the ER, but it's not connected in the way that, for instance, the nucleus is contiguous with the ER. So if you can label mitochondria and not see transit of that label to the ER, whereas if you label ER, you get nuclear labeling as well.
Kristen Jennifer's talk last week that some sort of molecules flow freely from the ER membrane to the mitochondria.
That's right. Yeah, so there are pores, and if you have small enough molecules, you definitely can. And then I think there's that regulation at those opposed membranes as well. But we tend to think of them as separable. They're not. It's not contiguous in the sense of ER. And it's also not, and the mitochondria aren't derived from ER the way, for instance, Golgi are. So.
And even in the case of mitochondria, there's a specific lipid in the inner membrane, it's called cardiolipin.
Yes.
And what about in chloroplasts?
In chloroplasts, specific lipids, there are specific lipids in certain membranes. Any hallmark ones that are notable that we should...
I didn't hear the question.
There's a statement about the lipid content in the inner membrane of mitochondria.
Yeah.
A specific lipid called cardiolipin.
Yeah, I
don't know
the answer to this.
No,
I think there's galactolipids, and I don't remember which membrane.
Galactolipid,
salt lipids.
I don't know, so.
But cardiolipin is not of bacterial origin.
I just thought that this would be a good time to interject that the two membranes around mitochondria, and I think around most bacteria, are really different from each other. That outer membrane, if you look at the protein composition, very low complexity. And the membrane itself has permeability to molecules of up to freely up to about 1,000 Daltons. So there are these pores, I guess, that you heard about last week or whatever, that are in this membrane. And then the inner membrane is really quite different membrane from any other membrane that we know about. It's about 75-80% protein. Just kind of pasted together with phospholipid and cardiolipin. And it's impermeable, so that's why you need all these transporters. It doesn't have holes in it where things can just kind of float back and forth. And the complexity of the membrane is amazing. You know, there are many, many proteins in that membrane. So just to give you an idea, those two membranes are about as different as any two membranes you can, you know, if you went looking.
And then the inner membrane and the acoustae add another layer of complexity and organization of subdomains to it. So it's actually almost like three membranes.
So one of the debates in the field has been why endosymbiosis? What was the advantage? And it's the hypothesis that's I would say, in my opinion, one of the best supported is that the early environment was very different from the early on in Earth's history. There was lots of hydrogen. there was lots of carbon dioxide, there was nitrogen, but there was effectively no molecular oxygen. And when photosynthesis evolved, then all of a sudden there was molecular oxygen, which was very damaging if you had, and oftentimes incompatible with the biochemistry that if you had involved, if you had evolved your biochemistry in a hydrogen and methane atmosphere, oxygen is poison for the for that type of metabolism. And so one of the ideas is that you had early eukaryotes that did not yet have mitochondria for whom oxygen was very toxic, and then there were bacteria who had figured out how to use oxygen aerobically and turn it back into CO2 and water, which were fine for these early eukaryotes. And so that by engulfing this symbiont, you actually had a protective advantage. It wasn't that you were going to get fed, it was simply that you could survive and get along and not and have a sink for the oxygen that was showering on you from the environment. And then that secondarily what evolved would be transferring ATP out of this, so not just using it to detoxify the environment, but then actually taking advantage of its ability to manufacture ATP. And one of the supports for this being a second phase is the ATP transporters that are in mitochondria that export the ATP manufactured within the mitochondria out to the cytoplasm. There aren't any bacterial counterparts. I mean, because it would be pretty stupid to be a bacterium exporting ATP, and that this was something that had to come along later. And that's another piece of evidence that I think supports this hypothesis is work from Steve McKnight, and now a number of other labs as well, have been looking at if you grow yeast cultures under careful conditions, you observe that the culture will organize itself to cycle in its use of oxygen. And so this is a graph over time of a yeast culture measuring the saturation of dissolved oxygen. So these yeast are growing in liquid, they're being bubbled with air, and they may take more or less air. They have this, dissolved oxygen available to them, and they may consume it, or they may pass and just let it accumulate. And so what's happening in this culture is, at this point, they stopped using oxygen, the oxygen rises, and then they're now possibly beginning to use a little bit of oxygen, and then they really go into an oxidative phase, and the dissolved oxygen declines in the culture as the yeast are consuming oxygen. And at some point, there's a switch again, and they stop using oxygen and go back. And so David Botstein's group at Princeton has been interested in this process. And while you can, if you're very careful, you can get this sort of synchrony, but if you look at any single cell in the culture, it's going through its own cycle of these events, that oxidation is temporally separate in a cell from this non-oxidative phase. And what's going on during this non-oxidative phase is actually DNA replication. And so DNA replication evolved way before oxygen showed up on the planet. And those are some of the most ancient proteins in biology and the most ancient process. And DNA replication is profoundly sensitive to oxidative damage. And so it may make a lot of sense for cells to separate these processes in time. And I think this argues for the oxygen toxicity hypothesis as well. Yeah.
I'm not sure that how precise this figure is, but yes. It seems like the depth of the minima mm-hmm. is going up as the time goes on.
Yes. So if you play with, so the degree of synchrony in these cultures varies, and so depending on how fast the cells are growing, the synchrony may be larger or smaller. And I would say at this point in this field, it's fascinating and nobody quite understands what's going on. There's almost not enough data yet even to think about this.
It's not an exact deterministic trend or something like that.
No, but there does seem to be, so if you do a lot of these, and just do sort of simple Fourier analysis, there's a fundamental period to this cycling that you can cycle. You know, there seems to be a fundamental frequency of 40 minutes, and then you can see different multiples of those depending on exactly what you ask of the yeast. Yeah.
This is just observation about the graph. It looks like both of these maxima have almost identical blips or little shoulders on both sides.
Yeah.
And then
here too. Yeah. Yeah. I think those things bear looking at. And I know we'll put these talks up online, and I've thrown in a few links for things you're interested in reading more. And so finally, I'm getting to your question about the genome sizes. So this is a figure from a really nice Science paper where they sequenced the genome of a free-living bacterium, it's actually a symbiotic bacterium that's dependent on a host, but it is actually its own organism. This Rickettsia, and so here's a diagram of its genome in relationship to the mitochondrial genomes of Arabidopsis. So plants actually tend to have relatively large mitochondrial genomes. The record holder for small is the malaria parasite Plasmodium falciparum, and our mitochondrial genomes are also quite small. They're only 16 kilobases of DNA, which is just totally tiny. So there's a lot of variety out there. And in all cases, these mitochondrial genomes are reduced from what it takes to be a free-living bacterium. The colors are, I would have to go back and look at this figure. I think the colors referred in part to GC content, but there was also gene type as well, I think. I would have to go back and look to be sure. Yeah.
So what is kept in even in the smallest ones? What kind of genes do they actually?
We have a figure for that. So let's see. There is, so here is, and then they also went and sequenced the largest known and probably the most ancestral genome of a mitochondrion is found in Reclinomonas, which is a single-celled organism. And so it has an example of basically all the genes. And so the fundamental things that get kept even down to the malaria parasite are some of the core enzymes of respiration. So, and this is sort of a hype, and people, this has always been a question of why bother with having a genome? You know, why have two genomes? Why deal with DNA replication in this incredibly oxidizing and possibly dangerous environment for DNA? Why not just send everything to the host nucleus? But there seems to be the common element of local control. So there's always at least a couple proteins of the respiratory complex that are retained by the mitochondrial genome. And so this suggests that maybe it's important for the mitochondrial genome to have its own input over the levels or function of these respiratory complexes by retaining at least a couple of the core protein subunits. And then if you're going to have proteins, you have to have the machinery to make them. So the other key elements that are still retained are the small and large subunits of the ribosomal RNAs, because if you're going to make protein, you have to have ribosomes. Carol.
So these three proteins, cytochrome B, cytochrome oxidase 1 and 3, are also the ones that are most embedded in the membrane. They have these multiple transmembrane domains. So if you look at the structures of the enzymes, which are known now, you'll see that they're the ones that are stuck in the phospholipid bilayer. And there's actually a nice experiment that was done many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, where they took the cytochrome B gene and tried to send it in from the outside. And they could, if they put a big honking leader on there, they could get one transmembrane domain in, they could get two, they could get three, and when they went up to four, then they couldn't get it in anymore. So there seems to be also a physical reason why you you can't have these out in the nuclear genome.
This is exactly the kind of connection that. So
that's actually experimental evidence.
Chloroplast.
I don't know, Kathy.
So the genes that are retained in chloroplasts. So one of these cool seniors tends to be that. I can't remember. That's part of the medical thing.
Yeah.
If that's a.
I also don't know of examples of such reduced chloroplast genomes either.
Right. So yeah. Chloroplast, but there are a few genes that
are always
that seem to be retained in more chloroplast genomes than others. I think I don't know if there's anything that's absolutely universal. I'd have to go.
The ribosomal RNA subunits, of course, I suppose, are absolutely universal.
Really? Some of them are imported.
Really? Wow. Wow.
And how many chloroplast genomes exist at this point, relative to mitochondria or
antimony? There are quite a few. I think there are a few hundred anyway.
Okay. They're just pulled up in shotgun sequencing of various plants now? Or are they specifically targeted?
No, they've been targeted. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was asking, are there respiratory genes in the nuclear genome, or they're not there at all?
Oh, yes. So the complexes of both of respiration and of photosynthesis are huge multi-subunit protein complexes, and there are many genes that are nuclearly encoded that must be imported to the mitochondria or to the chloroplast, respectively, to have the biochemical functions encoded.
But are these ones also there?
So in the case of organisms where they've, and it does seem like human is here, but in the cases of, Schizosaccharomyces, which is fission yeast here, now you will find examples of all of its RPS and NAD subunits that are now nuclearly encoded. So one of the,
one other interesting sort of evolutionary thing. So in Rhabdospora, ATPase subunit 9, so it's probably the most hydrophobic protein known. And it's in Rhabdospora, the active subunit is encoded in the nuclear genome. And it's only 81 amino acids long, but the leader is about 66 amino acids long and very hydrophilic, and somehow it's able to get it into the organelle. But the interesting thing is that there's a pseudogene that's left in the mitochondrial genome, so it's some kind of historic remnant there that's now inactive. So
that's very interesting. Yes, yeah, caught in evolution.
Who knows?
Not enough time to get rid of it, I guess.
Yeast has a lot of AT garbage in its genome too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And is plasmodium an exception because the heme metabolism is somehow aberrant?
So plasmodium, what it's doing with its. It's almost not fair to, and people for a long time until the genome of malaria was sequenced, there was argument about whether this was even a mitochondrion or what this thing was inside the cell. And then the sequence, after it was sequenced, it had the ribosomal RNAs that were of the bacterial type, and it had these subunits of respiration. But there's a group at Princeton who works on Manuel Linus who works on plasmodium, and he actually has collaborated with Josh Rabinowitz, who's here. Who's at Princeton working on metabolomics, and it is not even fair to use a normal metabolic chart to describe what's going on in plasmodium. It's totally different. My one cute aside about plasmodium, which I just love, is that if you look at the amino acid composition of all of the proteins that this organism makes, they are exactly that of hemoglobin, because the parasite it infects red blood cells, which are bags of hemoglobin, and that's all there is to eat, and so it has constructed itself to be exactly composed of hemoglobin, which is I think neat. These organelle genomes, it turns out that their gene loss is continual. When you have, and I guess if you look over evolution, that genes have been continually lost. And you can actually do experiments and watch that there, and I suppose it has to do with the fact that you have hundreds of copies of these genomes in the organism. You can do experiments where you put a selectable gene in the genome of a mitochondrion or a chloroplast and watch for its exit into the host nucleus. And this happens at a non-trivial rate. So everything gets the chance to go into the nucleus because there's sort of this shower of organelle DNA that's getting released perhaps when organelles are turned over. So the fact that the organelles are still holding on to these genomes, it's not that there hasn't been a chance for any single piece of organelle DNA to make it into the genome. And the fact that there are genes still there, and in the case of chloroplasts, that there's a ton of genes still there, argues that it's important to actually have the genes where they're needed. If you do the corresponding experiment and you have a gene in the nucleus and you look for it to appear in the organelle genome, that rate is, in yeast it hasn't even been properly estimated, but it's at least a millionfold less. So it's a very unidirectional from organelle to nucleus. But there are definitely cases, if you look over evolutionary time, where there was horizontal transfer from nucleus back into organelle. Casey?
I have a feeling this is going to come out and sound very stupid, but so everything that I have interpreted thus far has made it sound like there was one event where a bacterium was engulfed to create the first mitochondria. But it seems to me that if the mitochondrial genomes are getting rid of DNA at very fast rates, then the fact that you see such a wide diversity of mitochondrial genome sizes, I would have naively interpreted that to mean that there were many different engulfment events at different time points that could have been a very different bacteria, and you know what you're seeing is just different initial points rather than some wide dispersity of evolutionary rates from the initial starting point. Do we know that that isn't the case?
So the argument that that's not the case is that if you, all of the efforts of drawing trees, of taking proteins from every mitochondrial genome, you always get a single origin tree that looks like one event. Now, this was so long ago that it's debatable, and there are examples that can only be explained by horizontal transfer, but it's still so strongly monophyletic that it seems to be the best answer or explanation does seem to be that the loss events have been different through the tree of life.
So this experiment that you were talking about, is this only been in yeast or has it been done in multiple?
It's been done in plants as well, and
it's different.
I don't know exactly what the rates are in plants. I'd have to look. It's been done in Cerevisiae. I make it like it's trivial to transform mitochondria, and it's actually not. Do you know if it's been done in Pombe? Oh no, but they're central. It'd be harder. So,
If you could just follow up on that, so we've been reading papers by Kunin where they said there was no nucleus and the mitochondria came first, and then you came membrane to protect from mitochondrial DNA. And then we also heard last week that there's open and closed mitosis. So are these rates being measured in open?
Yes. So Cerevisiae is closed mitosis, and this has been measured in plants which have open mitosis, and we will have to look this up for you because I don't know.
How much of the difference is bulk action? You have 1,000 or 5,000 times mitochondrial genomes to one nuclear genome.
And the rates are not so far off from a bulk action argument.
Bulk action.
Plus closed versus open. So I think it's a really interesting question to look at the rates as measured in plants where you have the same bulk action but you have open mitosis. So,
So if the nuclear membrane is not protecting the genome, then why even have that hypothesis? That it was evolved to protect the
genome? Evolved to protect the genome?
Yeah.
I actually,
the
if I were, my opinion about it, involving a nuclear membrane is that it's great for gene regulation. That if I were going to evolve it, it wouldn't be to protect my genome. It would be to have regulation of transcription factor localization. But I can't off the top of my head think of the right experiment to what to look at in phylogenies to answer that question. Yes.
So is the transport machinery of proteins and other genes into mitochondria well known?
Yes. Let me show. I have some nice pictures of that. Unfortunately, it's not a topic that I am an expert on, but it is pretty well worked out. But yet, interesting problems remain. So first, this is a picture of mitochondria, and I have a very similar picture of chloroplasts. There are a lot of commonalities. So you've heard Carol mention several times a signal sequence. So when you have a protein whose destination is the mitochondria, it is held in unfolded form by chaperone proteins in the cytosol, and there is a signal sequence, and some of these are N-terminal, some of these are internal to the protein, that gets recognized by an outer membrane translocase, and then depending on whether there are further sequence signals, it can be passed on to, so this is TOM transport of the outer membrane, and then there's TIM transport of the inner membrane, if it has the appropriate sort of peptide address to be transported into the inner membrane. And then there are also signals for, because many proteins have, you know, exciting structures like this where you have ins and outs and ins and outs, and all of that needs to be properly coordinated and folded. And one of the things is the diameter of these translocases is such that you can't pass whole proteins through. It's too small of a pore. It needs to be sent through. And this translocation requires a gradient of ions, a charge gradient across these membranes. So they have to be, so if a mitochondrion is depolarized, it can't take up, you can no longer import proteins into it. And then just to be fair to chloroplasts, here's a similar diagram of chloroplasts. And again, you have free protein, you have chaperones in the cytoplasm, and then there is transport. And there's been a lot of work on the details of how, if you're going to end up in the outer membrane, to be an integral protein in the outer membrane or an integral protein in the inner membrane, that process. And I am unfortunately not the person to tell you about that. But I think, a lot of interesting protein biophysics involved in figuring out this targeting. And there are also some cases where things get dual targeted. So these targeting sequences can be flexible.
With that caveat, my question is sort of unfair, but this is topologically reversed to what happens in a normal happy bacteria. You have conservation of sequence between anything in your bacteria and the mitochondria or chloroplasts, right?
I think a lot of it. Yeah.
Other than invertebrates, you have the TIMS.
So a lot of these channels are the beta barrel sort of channels, yeah. and that is totally conserved. So, and now there's actually one of the people we invited who couldn't make it, whose name I'm forgetting right now, is studying these in Colobacter and their similarities, and I don't remember if they're inverted or not.
Okay.
But I can show you the paper, so you can take a look.
Sorry to interrupt
yes.
you, but
that's
the
right.
transport, protein yes. transporter, so it's going back to evolution, are these transporters, they're in any way homologous to all sorts of bacterial transporters like TAT or SEC?
They are. Yes. So some of them look very much like the bacterial sex. And so what we were talking about here is there's been some comparative work looking at, because this is not as Adam pointed out, normally the case would be you were a bacterial genome here and you were making stuff here and you needed to send it out. And this is the opposite problem, and whether it should be the case that topologically there, at least recognition and so forth have switched around, and I don't know the answers to that, but there are people working on this and we can point you to them. Yes.
But also the secretion machinery is also being made in the nuclear genome and put in, right? So the direction
that's
of
right.
that is also opposite in some
yes.
way, right?
Yes, and also because these are effectively bacterial proteins that and look the most parsimonious explanation for their origin is that they were encoded here in the bacterial genome, they got sent out, and now the host is sending them back in. And so this is actually an issue for the gene movement from mitochondrial genomes or chloroplast genomes into nuclear genomes. You can take up all the DNA you want, but you need to have a way to get the protein back in. And so it's not, you actually, if you go and you sequence eukaryotic genomes, yes, this is true both in plants and in animals, you will hit, if you're going along sequencing a genome, you will hit things that look like mitochondrial or if it's a plant, chloroplast genomes, long stretches of DNA, but that have also show the hallmarks of mutation over time, where there was a big chunk of DNA that got integrated into the genome, and then it just sat there and didn't get used because it didn't pick up the right changes for it to have the right kind of promoter, and then also the right kind of signal sequence to interact with the translocase. So it's sort of a very haphazard. It seems like the problem of getting successfully having a protein encoded by the organelle genome and getting it into the nucleus and having it function is not simple because it needs to get both the signal sequence to get back in and then also the right kind of, because a bacterial promoter is nothing like a eukaryotic promoter.
How hard would it be to change the polarity of transport without changing the polarity of the, is it pore vectorial? Is it pore vectorial?
Yeah, these are normally energy driven, and so you have a translocase that burns ATP or uses protons across the membrane to push through and thread through.
But is it in the pore that there's a vector, or is it just the start and the end? Because if you could change just the outer parts, switch them, like Legos back and forth, maybe you could use the pore in its opposite orientation.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that's an evolutionary challenge that's been done here, but might be tough for us to do in the lab.
Switching around two people. Take a lot of credit.
Yeah.
Boris.
So what's the latest question? Maybe explain it, and I just missed it.
Sure.
So what is happening in between the two membranes, right?
I totally glossed over that. it's called intermembrane space in mitochondria, and I'm forgetting what that space is called. It's the same intermembrane space in chloroplasts, and so there are proteins who make it through here, and that's their destination, and so they're sent through the outer membrane, but they don't have the signals. They have no further signals to send them further, either to the inner membrane or into the matrix. So that's their destination.
I guess the naive why question is, why bother having two membranes? So is there some sort of, ionic or, some sort of significant difference between these two components?
I'm sorry, I left that out quite completely. So here, what's happening is that you have protons that are within the inner matrix, and through the process of aerobic respiration, the protons get pumped out, and so that creates a gradient, and then you use the energy from that gradient as they fall back through to make ATP. So this inner membrane is used as a compartment to create the gradient, and that you can build energy across the gradient and then use that energy for the work of putting together a phosphate group on ADP.
So coming back to this previous question about the orientation of those transporters, but the transporters are not run by proton gradient.
They're
not running off PMF.
I believe in mitochondria, the proton gradient is required for inner membrane translocation, but I think it's ATP. Is it ATP or is it also proton gradient for outer membrane?
It can't be a proton gradient for the outer membrane.
But you definitely need it on the inner membrane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, it just stops.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I mean, why wouldn't you build everything into the inner membrane?
Well, now so for F1ATPase, you're sitting in the inner membrane, and you now don't expose the cytosol to this huge proton gradient. You need a membrane-bound motor through which you're flowing protons and then making ATP, but now you've protected the cytosol from all of these errant protons floating around.
But I thought the other one bit was porous, so the cytosol does see the gradient.
It's porous, isn't it?
It's porous, but let's see. So you have some negative charged things flow, but I don't know how the pores are set up, whether there's a sim porter for positive charge or not. I mean, with the malate shuttle, so there's a number of shuttle proteins in the outer membrane where you trade a negative charge for a negative charge, and you're just going by concentration gradients. The protons that are getting pumped into this intermembrane space aren't being released to the cytosol. They're not in equilibrium with the cytosol.
Wait a second. The bacterial outer membrane has a 1 kilodalton cutoff. But I'm not sure is that true in mitochondria as well?
That seems like what it sounded like Jennifer Lipkot-Schwartz was saying. Most of my familiarity with the outer membrane is that everything needs a transporter.
Case in mitochondria. That's a difference compared to gram-negative bacteria.
Yeah.
Well, that's important. Yeah.
So the one other point I wanted to make about organelle genomes, and this is my geneticist bias, is that, let's see. That these organelle genomes are maternally inherited, acceptance of a few funny cases, but for most things you think about, be it plants or animals. So in plants you have really interesting cases of problems with chloroplasts that are only maternally inherited. And so here we have in this genetic terms, the females are circles and males are squares. And so we have a brother, so this is the brother and a sister who were both affected by a disease, but all of her children are affected by the disease and his children are fine. This is an example of so-called maternal inheritance. And there are diseases in humans due to mutations in the mitochondrial genome they show this maternal inheritance pattern. There are also mitochondrial diseases because you've got lots of nuclear genes that end up in the mitochondria and affect mitochondrial function. But the hallmark of a mutation in either the mitochondrial chloroplast genome will be that it is transmitted only through one parent.
In population genetics terms, this is an asexual.
Yes. Yes, it is an asexual population, and so it's actually useful. So the mitochondrial inheritance in humans has been used to reconstruct ancestry in populations because since it's inherited only through the mother, you don't have the outcrossing events that.
Genes that went into the nucleus are now in an environment where there is recombination.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so this is only true for the genes that are encoded in the mitochondrial genome.
And there's theoretically mitochondrial Eve then, who's the...
So you can theoretically draw back all of the mitochondrial genomes to Africa.
We've heard from Michael Lynch about how just the population genetic environment makes a difference to the kinds of evolutionary steps you can take.
Yes.
So recombination helps you evolve more complex traits. Is it true somehow? Things into the nuclear genome, you were able to make this.
That's actually a really good point of what probably one of the pressures of getting things out into the nuclear genome is then you have the opportunity of recombination and sexual selection as opposed to being an asexual genome where you have no input or and no recombination. So absolutely. The one good thing you have with organelle genomes is because you have thousands of copies per cell, it's becoming clear that there are selection processes that happen in zygotes. So when you're forming a zygote, mom wants to have the very best mitochondria and chloroplast to pass on. And so there are, it's starting to become clear that there's you have a pool of mitochondria that is going to go into zygote, but only some of them get selected, and it seems that that's dependent on their, in the case of mitochondria, on their respiratory function and so forth. And so, because if you have 1,000 genomes, the likelihood is that some of them aren't perfect, and you'd rather be able to select the ones who are functioning properly and pass those on, as opposed to the ones that aren't. And so, the term for having this mixture of genomes, it is heteroplasmy, and there are actually cases where you can contrive to make a mouse that has a mixture of two different mitochondrial genomes, and then if you look at the progeny of that mouse, if one of the mitochondrial genomes functions less well than the other, you actually see selection for the functioning mitochondrial genome over the less functional mitochondrial genome in the progeny of that mouse.
I guess I had a question along those lines. I mean, we saw these beautiful pictures in the first week where the sperm tail is full of mitochondria.
Yeah.
It's not that they're not reaching there, right?
No, they're getting destroyed.
Selected away or something like that is happening, right?
So they get targeted for degradation, and also they lose out just by mass action. So the oocyte is huge, and there are a ton. But there are really cool cases, like in the alga Chlamydomonas, where you have effectively, you have two equals coming together in terms of size, and when you mate, the chloroplast of one individual and the mitochondrion of the other individual are targeted for destruction, and only one survives. So that argues completely. There's no mass action explanation there, and I believe there's pretty good evidence for destruction of the sperm mitochondria, even in cases of asymmetry in size between egg and sperm. I do not know. I learned the clammy story a long time ago, and I don't know where it's come to. We can maybe give you an update on that. It's such a beautiful system. You can go and.
So is there? You go ahead.
Is it along these lines? So is there some sort of bottleneck in sort of transmission of mitochondria where they actually go through a small number? Because so through division, it's so how many?
The size of the bottleneck is dependent on sort of the biology of various organisms, but it's quite a strong bottleneck in mammals. The mouse experiment I'm thinking of, where they had an individual that was heteroplasmic and then looked at the progeny, there were decreases of like 90% of reducing the bad mitochondria by 90% in some of the progeny. But then also, it could be that there's only 10 that go in and then they replicate or something. It's a lot. And then also, I want to, when we talk about numbers, we should talk about genome copies, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about the number of mitochondria or the number of chloroplasts. I guess you would make Poisson argument, the data would look, be sort of modeled in a Poisson type distribution if it was really low. And thinking about what's out there, I don't think it's not that low. We're not talking about 10. It's probably several hundred copies. But it is a large bottleneck in relationship to the pool that the mother has when forming the zygote.
So did anybody actually analyze the that sort of Mueller-Reichert type sort of accumulation of deleterious mutations in mitochondria? And
the mutation rate is much higher in mitochondria than in the nuclear genome. And so actually the clock is completely different. And the argument for that is in part that you have a more mutagenic environment. And
so has it been
I don't know the exact rates, but it's been looked at in a ton of organisms, and so we can definitely find the data.
The estimate is tenfold higher than the nuclear genome.
Mm-hmm. Are the rates different between different size mitochondrial genomes?
I don't know, but
one could imagine you select for a smaller genome with lack of DNA repair or excision repair.
But then that builds into, which I'll talk about in my part a little bit, this whole hypothesis about that one of the reasons you need fusion is actually to, you know, if you have pieces of, you know, that get really super damaged, that you have others that aren't. And so maybe if you have, for example, higher fusion, you know, you can compensate for one aspect of another. And that may actually be sort of the, that's really interesting, like for some of the morphology changes.
And so I think that's an excellent entree to talk about morphology.
Should we take a break?
Yeah, five break.
Well,
so this is the question. So we have
lots
of Z and 35 seconds. If we can do a half hour run now, finish it all. People are fine with that. We can find another time slot for.
Let's see how far we get.
Okay.
Okay, so. Yeah, no bathroom breaks if people can find it.
Okay, so. So in this sort of second half, I'm going to focus more on sort of this, I guess, the cell biology of the structure and dynamics of mitochondria and chloroplasts. And I'm going to start with just what do they look like, what are the dynamics that modulate what they look like, and then how that contributes to various aspects of function. Okay, so here's some pictures from this really nice review that show if the fluorescent signal is mitochondria. And this is, you know, cardiomyocytes and skeletal muscle, and the mitochondria and muscle align very beautifully with the muscle cells in order to be able to provide very localized ATP to the myosin motor for contraction. And then if you go into sort of more spread out cells, and you saw some of this already from Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz's lab, you have sort of a network of interconnected tubules that can be at stages of, you know, greater or lesser fragmentation, and these are actually even in, you know, stem cells. They can look very different depending on what type of cell you have. This is a more extreme example. These are all flap tissue culture cells, and you can go from small individual mitochondria to really long ones just based on the tissue, also based on the cell cycle stage, like Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz said, but even within each, you know, within each cell type, there's a steady state that the cell wants to achieve. And there can be, you know, various functions for these differences in morphology, and thinking about how these types of morphologies are achieved and sort of the basic rules that are required and whether those are important for function, are important questions in the field. In yeast too, you have a different sort of organization. The mitochondria form a sort of cage. They form a reticular network that fuses and divides, and I'll show you lots more pictures like this, that sort of keeps them at the periphery of the cell. So how are they distributed in the cell? And in most mammalian cells and most sort of cells that you see lots of papers on, it's via microtubules. And in certain yeasts and certain other systems, it's via actin cables instead. But you can see here's your picture of live mitochondria, and then the same cell was fixed, and microtubules were stained, and you can see that there where there are microtubules, there are also mitochondria, and their sort of elongated shape is very, you know, dependent on also having a cytoskeletal track that they move along, which we'll also get to.
And these are bound by kinesins or all types of?
So kinesins and dynamins, and actually Bill will talk a lot about that in his talk. I'll have a little movie from his lab in a couple of slides. And myosins in yeast, that gets more complicated. We'll get into that. So the fundamental sort of shape is that you have these, you know, tubules. And in yeast, there are a bunch of mutants, proteins that were identified that cause these tubules to disappear and to form sort of swollen, you know, spherical mitochondria, which have all sorts of problems. Clearly, it's much harder to inherit something that is not distributed, can't be pulled on the normal track, can't fit through the butt neck, etc. And a lot, you know, these proteins were identified to have various small functions that are all sort of starting to come together to build a picture. And one of the biggest pieces to that is that they also become part of this complex, which is called three different things in the literature. I'm going to refer to it as the mitochore. And these are actually the sites in yeast where the ER and the mitochondria actually do juxtapose. And members of this complex span both mitochondrial membranes, and one member is actually on the ER. And they also, members of this complex, so they bling things, you know, they bling spots in tight juxtaposition so that you can transfer lipids between the two organelles. And they also associate with, in yeast, the actin cytoskeleton and with mitochondrial nucleoids. So the mitochondrial DNA, these genomes that we talk about, are organized into nucleoids. There's about 10 to 50 in a yeast cell, for example, and each of those has multiple copies of the genome. And even within those, there's super organization of the genome. But these nucleoids themselves seem to be attached to near sites of ER contact and near sites of actin cytoskeleton, and it may be a way that you sort of maintain the entire integrity of the tubular structure. The details of this are not known. This is a very recent sort of finding, and people have been struggling with these things for a while. But I think this will slowly get worked out. And we don't actually know if this is exactly how it works in mammalian cells, although there are suggestions that there are similar conserved. And this is the nice thing about studying mitochondria and yeast. A lot of the machinery that's found has a fundamental sort of, you know, similar function and system in mammalian cells, although there are then regulation differences that come up. So that's, you know, the general structure is sort of tubular. What happens on the inside? Here's some cross sections. I had not seen this before. So it's actually, this is really suggestive to some very interesting proteins shaping membranes inside these astrocytes. And I literally just saw this yesterday, and I think I will look into this more because these are very, you know, very characteristic shapes to be appearing inside this organelle. This is sort of what you see often in pictures, right? So cardiac muscle, and you have, you know, the inner membrane invagination. So these are the cristae, and they can vary themselves in their organization. Yes.
What would the, if I was to take a slice of the higher or lower, with the sort of more funky shapes?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would assume it could be that the cristae themselves are somehow maintained in this weird triangular shape. I really have no idea. I didn't even know this existed until yesterday. So. So the way you could imagine that, okay, so let me just tell you about
cystine. Where are the proton gradients there?
No, so like what would happen is, okay, let's talk about a normal cystine and see if we can extrapolate. So there's several hypotheses for what cystine are. Some people, you know, some models had them just being, you know, spanning actually both sides of the inner membrane, and the more sort of, they said the more accepted model now is this cristae junction model. So you have inner membrane, and you have inner membrane that can fold into cristae, and the cristae can separate themselves off. And then you have these junctions, and these junctions, and you have differential protein localization depending on where you are inside the inner membrane. So, you know, you have ATP synthase here in these cristae. You have, I can't see. There's the iron sulfur cluster proteins are in here too, but other proteins are localized to the inner membrane that is not cristae, and these junctions may be important for the structural organization and tubulation. So to extrapolate to this, here's just a picture. You could imagine that there's something else that's maintaining, so you know, to sort of have the tubulation proteins themselves somehow are interacting with each other, maybe in some oligomerization state that enforces that shape. And that could be just at the cristae, or it could be then transduced to the rest of the door. Oh, you may have really short cristae there. I don't know. Yes. Cristae are these. That's what the invaginations of the inner membrane are called. And they can form. There's actually a bunch of models probably form. I have a slide on that, which I'm not going to show right now. If you're interested, we can talk about it. They could butt off, or they could be generated, you know, by things. You know, they're little pieces of cristae that fall off that are on the inside. And some people actually believe that it's almost like a vesicular trafficking system within the mitochondria.
So what we see in astrocytes is a mitochondria in astrocytes.
This is a mitochondria in astrocytes and a cross section, and that's what the cristae look like. I don't have more explanation because this was very.
This is the cross section.
I think so.
It's not just the surface.
It's a transmission electron micrograph,
yes,
through a very thin slice.
So the tubule would be coming at, you know, the whole mitochondria should be coming at you, the tubular shape of the mitochondria. And there must be cristae there along. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the organization is. I can't tell you. But I'm going to look into this one more. Okay, so why does that matter? Well, of course, cristae are really important for function, but cristae also establish sort of the overall shape So here, for example, the ATPase forms dimers, which then oligomerizes, and so that constrains the membrane shape in specific ways. And if you get rid of the domains that allow this oligomerization, you actually form really strange mitochondrial shapes that, again, here your wild-type cristae, actually, what happens here is that the cristae that form these onion shapes that are pretty well known, actually. People like to think and ponder about how these form. And the idea is that in order to form the cristae, in order to form these structures, you need that oligomerization of the ATPase to bundle them or to support them or distribute them. And if you get rid of that, you just keep accumulating membrane, and it's just the easiest thing for it to do is to keep accumulating and form these spirals. So cristae morphology is very important for overall morphology, and controlling cristae morphology becomes very important. It also, yes?
Is cristae, are they stacks or tubes? Or?
Yeah, so they're... So this is the inner membrane. This would be the cristae, and at some point it would be a tube. That tube could be like you have a tube here, and then you have a little piece here, and a little piece here, so it could be a tube that itself pinches off. There are inner membrane, well, there's controversy about whether there are inner membrane pinchases, but there could be other ways, other proteins that, allow pieces of the cristae come off. This is actually a very difficult field because you have to, image all of this with EM, which is very hard to know what's going on in a three-dimensional way, and it's its own field, and but...
Is this a dynamic thing?
Yeah, cristae are dynamic.
Okay, right.
Yes, so... But so no one's been able to visualize cristae with a light microscope well, because it's too small. So you can see, this is with really nice microscopy for the entire mitochondria, and the cristae would be substructures within that tubule. So how dynamic they are is a hard question in a sort of direct visualization manner. But the membranes are incredibly dynamic, and you'll see pictures of that tomorrow. So I assume the cristae are also forming and breaking up constantly.
So is there a different lipid composition in the cristae, or it's same as the inner membrane?
So as Carol was saying, the inner membrane is special because it's got a really, really high protein content. But the way that the proteins segregate is different. Now that could be it could be a feedback loop, right? It could be proteins segregate in a certain way. There, where you get the ATPase, you can start forming tubules, and that becomes a cristae, and other proteins can't go there. Or it could be some active process, but that's unclear. But they definitely have a different. They can have a different protein composition, and there are specific proteins in the respiratory chain, for example, that want to be at the cristae. The cristae are always believed to just increase the surface, area of the inner membrane. But because you actually have these specific domains, they can, participate in very specific functions. And some of that, like for example, in apoptosis, the cristae structure affects strongly how much cytochrome C is released. So I'll show that at the very end as well.
Sure. The schematic you have there?
Yeah.
The ATPase, are they usually found at the ends of these, at the sort of the deepest well part of the...
I don't
even find it on the flat part.
I think you can find the ATPase everywhere. I don't think it's just at the tips. But I don't know very much about that. When you have a dimer, it forms sort of a very sort of interesting shape that may constrain and cause curvature of the membrane. I don't know at what scale. And then when you oligomerize, that may either become more or less steep. And I think that may even depend on the organism and exactly how the ATP synthase. I don't know the answer to that.
Out on the flat part of the inner membrane. You meant, are they all in the pockets?
Are they always
in the pockets? Supposedly, they like to be in the cristae and not in the rest of the inner membrane. Okay. So the pockets are the cristae.
Are there any filaments there? Actin or...
This is inside the mitochondria. There's no actin inside the mitochondria, is there? In some weird way. I mean, there's actin in the nucleus, right? So you never know what could happen. There's nothing known of that sort. In plastids, you have the FTSC proteins, which I'll show in a second, which are the bacterial homologs of tubulin. And so I don't know if in plastids, but plastids have I don't know if the stroma have. Are there filamentous proteins that are involved in shaping the stroma?
Not is okay. Not better known.
There are. Bacteria has tubulin homologs.
Yes, which we'll get into, which is really important for plastid division. But in the mitochondria, you actually don't have that. Well, certain species do, and that. Well, but I don't think that's what's affecting this. That's put it that way. We'll get to that. Okay. So speaking of which, I'm sort of switching between mitochondria and chloroplasts and same aspect of structure. So I don't have any really good pictures describing the structure of the thylakoids. I found one nice picture, but it was actually so complicated that I didn't quite know how to wrap my mind around it. Basically, there, you know, I think membrane and protein deposits form all sorts of interesting helical pitches and structures that I don't know if Kathy wants to say more about those.
Well, I'm just going back to what we were talking about.
Yeah.
There are differences in membrane composition, but there certainly are differences in protein distribution in the stacked portion of the thylakoids versus the unstacked region. So the photosynthetic complexes are distributed differently,
yes.
And they can move around depending on light conditions.
Right, and which, you know, and that comes back to the dynamics question. You want the inside to be fully dynamic and constantly changing in response to things like, you know, light conditions or in the case of mitochondrial respiratory, you know, requirements. So, okay, so chloroplast, morphology. Now, mitochondria definitely, mitochondria definitely tend to form, like to form networks. You know, they fuse and divide a lot, which we'll get into. Chloroplasts do look a little bit more like their bacterial ancestors. You know, if anyone's looked at under any fluorescence microscope on the plant cell, you know, chloroplasts autofluoresce in red, so you can see them very easily. Here's a picture of Chlamydomonas, and Carol will tell you more about Chlamydomonas. And Chlamy has one single chloroplast that actually forms sort of a U-shaped cup, and it has super organization. For example, the eye spot is contained in the chloroplast, which I didn't know.
Well, part of it is, yeah.
Part of it is. So you'll hear more about that from Carol. Here's the sort of best general picture I could find of just a field with a bunch of chloroplasts. The epidermal cells are labeled in green, and underneath is the mesophyll, and you can see, you know, different cells with different size chloroplasts, so they can be small, they can be large, you can have different numbers. And this was what Amy was sort of referring to. In cells, it's known that chloroplast compartment volume is maintained. So if you have a smaller number of chloroplasts, they tend to be larger in size, or a larger number of chloroplasts, they're smaller in size. And they even know a little bit about what may regulate this. This is a really interesting story, and if people are interested, I can post those papers. And it may be affected by proteins that actually homologs to bacterial mechanosensitive channels that respond to osmotic pressures and requirements. So by stretching or not stretching the membrane, these may allow influx or efflux of solute and then alter the shape and volume accordingly. And this may also be somehow regulated by abscisic acid. But chloroplasts do have another sort of interesting structure as part of them. So here, for example, is what you would think of as the normal chloroplast that we would see really easily in autofluorescence. If you have stromule-targeted GFP, you can see stroma-targeted GFP, you can see these tubules, which are called stromules, which are extensions of the chloroplast. They're really thin, and they contain stroma, so they have both membranes and the stroma. And they're sort of very interesting. They don't exist in all cell types and all conditions. They change during development. And what I thought was very interesting, one of their possible functions perhaps, is that their length is negatively correlated with plastic density. So they tend to be much longer. This is just developmental stages growth of this plant cell, such that they have much longer stromules when they have a lower density. So they can be a way of, as you change the volume or surface area ratios of the chloroplasts that are present in the cell, if you need more membrane or you need more stroma for exchange with the environment, you can produce that in clearly and potentially a regulated manner, which is very interesting. They can transmit the, you know, proteins diffuse freely in them, and small pieces of DNA can move in them, but the genomes don't move around inside these stromules. And they can actually connect chloroplast to chloroplast. So if you bombard, you know, a cell with a chloroplast construct, so you can image your chloroplast, you wouldn't hit all of the chloroplasts, but often you can actually get all of the chloroplasts labeled, and they believe that might be due to stromule, you know, chloroplast-chloroplast connection.
And how big are the stromules?
Yeah. How thin are they? They're probably, what, I guess, a fifth or an eighth, tenth or something. They're pretty small of a chloroplast diameter. I would say they're probably...
The the overall chloroplast or the
stromal?
Chloroplasts are larger. So mitochondria are about 100 to 200 nanometers, and chloroplasts are like five microns. Yeah. And so these guys are probably more like mitochondrial-sized outgrowths of the chloroplast. And they are definitely affected by cytoskeleton and pulling, which we can get to. So they sort of may be similar in some ways to mitochondria in the pulling, not in the maintaining of structure.
With regards to the mitochondria, you have this picture of this cage of the yeast.
Yeah.
That seems to be on the periphery, right?
Yes.
And up there on the top left, that's sort of, I presume, my point being that it looks quite different from any cage. There doesn't seem to be any clear pattern as to where the chloroplast.
Yeah, well, I'll show you that in a moment. The mitochondria were sort of in this cage. Chloroplasts move in response to light, so they will move to certain sites of the plant cell. Depending on where the light's coming from, I'll show you really nice pictures of that.
Does not a torn move?
Mitochondria move around.
But not like huge stuff.
Yeah, but they remodel, and I'll show you a lot of pictures of that tomorrow, actually, in the yeast cells. So they're constantly moving on the microtubules. Actually, we'll have some movies of all this in very briefly. So dynamics, exactly that. So the types of dynamics, when people say dynamics, is there's fission, there's division, replication, right, of the actual organelle. There's fusion. Which remodels it, and then there's the movement of transport, which maybe I'll jump to. Okay, so So this is going to be very, very introductory because Kathy will take you guys through all of this in great detail tomorrow. So one of the things you have to do is you have to, divide. You have to create more, and then make sure it gets to and inherited to the two cells that are growing, dividing. Okay, so chloroplasts divide by binary fission, which is different from mitochondria in some ways because mitochondria are network. Chloroplasts are these discrete units, and it does so by mechanisms that are coordinated from the inside and the outside, and they are slightly different. So on the inside, basically you have the bacterial FESC system that has evolved in chloroplasts that allows for the building of a Z-ring for very importantly the positioning of the Z-ring in order to divide by binary fission. And if you misplace the Z-ring, you can see then you get lots of different Z-rings in long places and all sorts of sling shapes of chloroplasts. And that's all I'm going to say because Kathy will take you through a beautiful story of this. So this is where, if you think evolutionarily, you have the conservation of the bacterial division machinery in the chloroplasts, and that's maintained. You additionally have, and that's not true for mitochondria, which we'll get to. So for mitochondria, I'm going to jump back and forth a little. For mitochondria, you also have a pinchase, which is actually a dynamin-related protein. So in the family of dynamins, dynamins are proteins you may have heard about already. They also cause the pinching of tubules when you have endocytosis. Basically, whenever you have some sort of membrane that you want to form a slight tubular structure or some sort of pinching action, you have these proteins that can assemble, and they can be regulated in their assembly, and they form these nice spirals. And then with GTP hydrolysis, they can constrict the spirals. So you can form tubules and change the shape of the tubules directly. And mitochondria, this is the mechanism by which the tubules divide, and they can divide in many spots, so it's not binary fission. So you no longer have this sort of requirement for placement from the inside. For chloroplasts, you still have this placement on the inside by the FESC system, and you use the dynamin system from the outside. So evolutionarily, it becomes sort of interesting, and I don't know, Kathy may have some things to say on this. I don't actually know, but I would speculate it's known, it's believed mitochondria were endosymbiosed first, and then the chloroplast, and the chloroplast maintained its FTS Z-ring system, and mitochondria, required this dynamin system. I don't know if that may have actually come from the mitos to the chloros, or do you think it just had both?
They're probably the common ancestor.
Okay. So what's really nice in all of this, so this is where I talk a little bit about evolution, or most of my talk is just cell biology, is the dynamins have a bacterial ancestor, which is a bacterial dynamin-like protein that can also tubulate. And this was just discovered in 06, and it's just the structure of it has just been solved last year. So we've got dynamins that come from bacteria. We've got the tubulin homologs and positioning that comes from bacteria. And together, those allow for, you know, the division machinery. I was going to say something, but I totally just forgot.
But when you say they come from bacteria, you mean that they're not in the last common ancestor of all cells, but somehow evolved in bacteria and then came?
That they may have been provided to eukaryotes via their endosymbiosis. So I don't know all the details for the support for this, but it's believed that, for example, the dynamins that are so important in eukaryotic cell biology may actually have originated by this endosymbiosis event, and had they had the mitochondrial or the common ancestor bacterial dynamin that then was used, you know, usurped by the host. Dynamin for mitochondria is not, it's in the nuclear genome, not in the mitochondrial genome. One really cool thing about...
What does dynamin do in bacteria?
I don't think it's known what dynamin does in bacteria.
No.
It's just known, so, you know, in a similar manner. So I don't even know if it's the same story as FTSZ, like the sequence homology is not great, but the structural homology is really high, or is it also sequence?
I think for the dynamic, like bacterial dynamic-like proteins, I think it's mainly the GTPase
domain, and that's how that is conserved, and then that's how they identify it.
So
okay.
The chloroplast mitochondrial dynamins are. I mean, we sort of think of them as being eukaryotic in origin because they don't look
right.
Like the bacterial dynamins.
But they had to come from somewhere.
Right, but probably in some murky evolutionary path, the dynamins did have a bacterial
origin. Bacterial origin.
Yeah, but there's the evolutionary transition is, you know.
Is complicated, yeah.
I think it's not really understood.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. So I do know for what I find really interesting in the sort of evolutionary transition, you know, from more or less bacterial to from mitochondria, if you go back, you know, to red algae, you actually still do maintain the FTZ protein. So you know, most mitochondria, you know, in the higher, you know, in mammals and higher eukaryotes do not. And so there's this really beautiful sort of, you know, they were bacteria, they still had the same machinery, they decided that they didn't need it as much while the chloroplast maintained it in the plant. So. In mitochondria, I will have a picture of this tomorrow. In the whole, for example, in a yeast cell network, fission can occur in many places, and fusion occurs in many places. And how that relates to the position of the nucleoids is actually not well established, and that's actually what I'm going to try to do in some of my work. So the idea is that the nucleoids are distributed everywhere in the network, and so if you also have semi-random fission-fusion locations, you would, you know, distribute those into different pieces.
Fission that encloses something that is without any DNA?
You can, absolutely. Yeah.
And what happens to that?
It can refuse. If it has DNA that's damaged, if the contents are damaged, it can be sent for degradation. I have a nice picture on that. So yes, absolutely. And it's a constant state of fluctuation.
Let you see this in SR2 cells in Drosophila.
Pardon?
You see this in SR2 cells in Drosophila, SR2. You have pinching events which don't enclose any DNA.
Any DNA, yeah. And then you also have temporary pinching events. So for what I do as well, this is not absolutely perfect. If you use a matrix marker and you have intermembrane pinching of some sort, right, that's not actually the full division of the organelle. So often you have spots where you can have, you know, pinching and unpinching gets very rapid. And some groups believe that you don't have intermembrane pinching, and some groups believe that this is this shows intermembrane pinching that is not fully resolved. And that's still being sort of discussed and debated. You do not require a protein for intermembrane pinching. If the dynamin pinches from the outside, that is sufficient.
Are there some strains of cells, I remember cultured cells that are called Rho0, that have no DNA in the mitochondria?
Right.
And they're maintained.
The mitochondria are still maintained because while in yeast, so this is what Amy was talking about, in yeast, you know, you can have fermentation, you don't actually need the mitochondrial DNA, you don't need respiration, you do require the iron sulfur clusters. Mitochondria are essential, so you still have to maintain them. But these cells go very poorly, and you know they have many problems.
And like how you do fusion, fission, and the other things that they need.
And those cells, I don't actually know. I need to look at them. But it's reported that they have normal morphology, which I would suggest normal fusion, fission. But that's actually a very good question.
Can you speak a little bit about the assembly trip?
Yes, absolutely.
I understand how. Just energetically, I understand hydrolysis because you're creating more surface areas. But I don't understand assembly.
Yeah, so there's a beautiful paper by the Denari Lab in Science from last year. The easiest thing is for you to take a look at because they really spend a lot of time on this. But basically, there's the dynamin protein that assembles into these helices, and there's another protein that may form a scaffold, and it basically, so in the same way that in the actin world you have the nucleators of actin polymerization, this protein basically is a nucleator of dynamin polymerization. So it is what's taking care of the sort of problems of the energetics in some way, and it's because it is interacting with another protein in the membrane. So it's specifically to how the topology and organization of these machines is set up that helps. Yeah. But it's a really good, Okay. So in yeast, here's some pictures. So you have fission, and in plastids you require fission for binary fission. In yeast you have fission and fusion. That is remodeling the network. So here you have, for example, a fission event and a fusion event. And fission and fusion have to be balanced in order to maintain the morphology. And if you don't, so if you, for example, decrease fission, you get overfused networks, or decrease fusion, you get over what I call overfizz divided networks. And I'm going to talk about this more tomorrow and how that relates to, understanding the structure. But fusion is not super simple. There's two membranes, and both of them have to fuse, and there's distinct steps. So the Denari Lab also had developed an in vitro assay for yeast mitochondria, and they have now done this as well for mammalian mitochondria. And basically, without going into the details of which proteins connect how, they found that you need a proton gradient for the outer membrane fusion, and you need a electrical potential for inner membrane fusion. So basically, you need functional mitochondria that are doing what they are doing to have fusion. If you have a piece that can't fuse, it's so damaged that it doesn't, like say you have a piece without DNA, if it refuses really quickly, it might be fine, but if it's sitting there, nothing's happening, and it loses its potential due to who knows what, it can't refuse. So it's automatically sort of segregated, and it gets targeted for degradation. Here is Phil's movie. So this now gets at movement and transport, and this does occur by kinesins. Dynines, and you're going to hear a lot from Bill on this. This is just really beautiful. This is an axon. And so, in neurons, you have this more complicated situation that you really need to get the organelles to where they need to be, and you need the mitochondria and the synapse to provide energy, and for signal for calcium, too. I don't actually know. I thought that was the case.
People think that.
Yes. And so you really are dependent on the transport for the function, and that's where a lot of the sort of mitochondrial-related, neurodegenerative diseases can come from, which I'm not even going to touch on because this is Bill's domain. So, in yeast, yeast have actin cables. That's what the mitochondria move on, not on microtubules. And actually, actin is important in mammalian cells as well. It's been shown now that if you mess with actin, the small movements of mitochondria gets decreased, not the long movements of mitochondria. That's a very recent paper as well. People don't quite understand what's going on there yet. For yeast, mitochondria move along actin cables. That's how they're transmitted from the mother to the bud. But there's also, and that's believed to be partly due to myosin. It's also due to attachment of the mitochondria at the bud tip. So while the bud is barely grown, if you have something that anchors the mitochondria and then the bud grows, they will get, moved that way. They also attach to actin cables, and so they also get maintained in the mother because the actin cables are undergoing retrograde flow because they're polymerizing. So the plus ends are at the bud neck, and so if you, keep inserting actin here, then you are going to move the actual, say you're looking at a spot on this, cable backwards. And so mitochondria that are attached but not quite moving, say the kinesins holding them or some other protein, can move backwards. And then this really strange thing that has not been understood how exactly it's happening is there is a protein that's localized to mitochondria that seems to interact with the actin nucleator R2-3 for dendritic actin branch nucleation, which is how cells move, and which is how the bacterium Listeria moves around inside the cell by forming these comet tails that some of you may know about. And it's associated with mitochondria, but people claim they, it's pushing the mitochondria in small ways, but there's been very little shown clearly about how that's achieved or what its role is. If you get rid of that and you look at actual individual movement on the actin cables, it's decreased. But transport, the net transport of all of the organelle may not be affected as much as the small movement. The small movement functions maybe for something else than just inheritance, like it functions for example, if you have two tubules and you want them to, fuse, they have to come into contact with each other. So, chloroplasts. So, first, first of all, you know, chloroplasts are situated in the cell, and I'll show you how they move in response to light, but they don't move a huge amount, given the fact that there's very great cytoplasmic screening happening in the plant cell. And they actually, you know, by the fact that they maintain their position, yes, we have to go.
Yeah, we probably have to, the reason we have to go is because it's actually, we need to get lunch and bring it back here to the Blackboard talk. So we need a little bit of time to do this. So what we could do is, so there's a wine and cheese at 5, which is over there, but if we can meet at about 3:30 or 4, people are not jet lagged or if they're still up for this kind of thing, then we can, what I would say is we should continue this, finish it off, and then at this time we can play Mike Nelson's movie if people want to see that, and then go get wine and keep talking.
3:30 or 4.
So is